anywhere it's complex, where there's uncertainty, Scrum will encourage you to have the right conversations. It won't fix your problems.
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the award-winning tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats.
This episode, we're joined by Steve Trapps. Steve is the co-owner of Scrum Facilitators, an experienced Scrum Master, and a professional Scrum Trainer with over 20 years of experience in delivering complex products in many different business sectors.
In this episode, we answer the age-old question, can cybersecurity teams actually do Scrum? We'll do a deep dive into when you should and shouldn't use Scrum in your cybersecurity teams, and of course, learn exactly what a Scrum Master does.
We also explore how Scrum can be used to foster better conversations, create transparency, and help you achieve your goals.
And how to be an A1 facilitator like Steve with the use of visuals and liberating structures. And how not to get caught up in the dogma of the Scrum Guide.
We love this chat and we think you will do too, so sit back and enjoy our interview with Steve Trapps.
Welcome to another episode of Compromising Positions. We've got a fantastic guest with us today. Steve Trapps, the co-owner of Scrum Facilitators, an experienced Scrum Master and a professional Scrum Trainer with 20 years plus experience. Now, I met Steve because he actually helped me on my way with my professional Scrum Master cert. And I'm really delighted for that because I think it really helped me, firstly, when I was starting in my journey as a software developer, understanding how to work with other software teams and how to work more cohesively. But then as a cybersecurity professional really helped me understand actually people don't work in the same way as cybersecurity teams does and how does that have an impact, and we might delve into that during the conversation today. But after that intro, Steve, do a better job than I did. Who are you and what do you do?
Who am I? A jack of all trades. So as you talk about that, I was originally a developer and I built a lot of the websites out there in the world, which then fell over. A lot of the stuff for Sky, and I worked at Sky for a bit, and then I then became frustrated really about how we were delivering things and thought there's got to be an easier way. There's got to be a better way than this kind of constant treadmill of hitting my head against the brick wall and trying to answer that question of when. So I went down the route of looking at Scrum just because it is and was at the time the most popular framework out there to help deliver in complex situations. So I ended up doing all sorts of things before I became a professional Scrum Trainer. I became a technical architect. I became a head of technology, but really my passion is helping people to deliver in complex worlds in which we all seem to find ourselves in, and answer that elusive question of when can I have it. So what I do, or what I hopefully I do, is provide pragmatic experience with an aspect of coaching, because I'm also a coach with the International Coaching Federation. Pragmatic experience, coaching, professionalism is key to what I do and operate. There's lots of times throughout my career I've thought, do you know what? It would be easier if I just took the easier route, if that makes sense, or the less controversial. But what's the professional way? What should I be doing here as a professional? And that's often caused me some grief, as in difficult conversations, but I know it's been the right conversations to have at that right time. So yeah, so a long way of saying a jack of all trades, but trying to use the experiences I've picked up elsewhere to help other people.
And I think you do it so well. What really struck me about the session I was involved with over a few days was your facilitation style. I've not seen since, actually, and it was a pleasure. And whenever people ask me to, you know, recommend trainers for Scrum and Agile, your name is always the first one that comes out of my mouth. And I think it was because your really visual style as well, the way you get us all together, and you have these amazing drawings that you do, and then your use of like bringing everyone on board. Because I don't know if you probably, this is probably why you're such a great facilitator, but there's always going to be someone in the room who's like, I don't respond well to like getting everyone together in a room. Start drawing on paper, start engaging in that way. How do you bring people on for that journey when there's so many different styles?
Yeah, I mean, that is difficult. And I think over time, you start picking up those skills or picking up. And look, if you go on training and somebody doesn't want to be there, there's nothing you can do as a trainer to help them be there. It's often the case of, look, you're spending time with me. You may as well try and get something out of it, whether or not it's like lots or just a little bit that's going to help you. But when you're ready, I'll be here. And that's kind of links into that coaching aspect as well, of like you can coach people. You can't coach people if they don't want to be coached. It's like pushing water up a hill. You can't do it. They have to be ready. So, and first off, thank you very much for that compliment. But I am really just standing on the shoulders of other people that have come before me and other trainers out there that I've seen do it. Simon Rindle, another scrum.org trainer, very knowledgeable, very experienced, really professional around how he approaches one training and also scrum. And the visualization was something that I shouldn't really say this as a trainer. It was the best course I ever went on. It was a visual facilitation course in London, just actually, I think it was just pre-COVID. And it was with Marcus DeVale and Charles-Louis Demers, who put on 2 days of just how do you draw? And it's something that we haven't done from, you know, nursery school or primary school. It's like, how do you draw and how do you get a message across? And in fact, I was doing some stuff with scrum.org the other week and there were some trainers on there and they asked me to describe something. And I just flipped the camera on and just started drawing and took them through a story. So it just kind of becomes, I think it's the way that my head works as well. If I can visualize it, then that helps me understand. And in fact, I'm jumping around loads of places here. We did a conference, Scrum Facilitators did a conference in the Netherlands about 2-3 weeks ago. And we were talking about neurodiversity. We were talking about how people pick up different bits of knowledge based on the way that they're, you know, wired up. And some people, especially if you have dyslexia or anything like that, visualization is so much easier to take stuff in. So drawing things out and talking, hey, this is the way that we work, is a very useful technique. Linking into those techniques, there's something called liberating structures. Now, you on the course probably didn't even realize I was doing it, how it was structured. And there's 33 different structures. And it's like, hey, just go off and have a think for a minute by yourself. And now I'm going to put you into some pairs. And now we're going to get some more people to come and talk to each other. And that's a liberating structure called 1-2-4 and all. And there's, like I said, there's 30 odd ones of them. But what it does, it can be very daunting for people in training. And the whole of the agile aspects of ways of working is, hey, we're transparent and just share your information. It can be very daunting for people if they're not used to that way. Or what can happen is that certain individuals dominate a conversation. So by me sending you off to do a minute thinking by yourself, it's giving you that time to think, as opposed to somebody who's quite gregarious or somebody that's quite outspoken and dominant dominating that conversation. So none of the stuff I do is original, and I wish it was, because, you know, it'd be great. But I'm literally, like I said, standing on the shoulders of other people that have come, giants before me, and I'm just piecing things together. So, and hopefully helping, and it kind of links into what I was saying earlier, helping others to piggyback off that and take that into where they work. Because hopefully when you went back to your organization, you thought, hey, I've got this meeting and I need to facilitate something, or I'm going to try that thing that we did on that course. And it's one of the things that we do at Scrum Facilitators. It's actually very rarely, we don't show PowerPoint. We'd much rather have a conversation. We'd much rather facilitate, and you're all equal. It's just that maybe some of us have read a book or two a bit more than you have, or a page ahead of you. And it's that experience of people coming together. So it's like I say, I'm literally standing on the shoulders of giants that have come before.
One thing that struck me of what you were talking about just then was you were doing it virtually as well. So the visual can be virtual as well.
Yeah. Very much. Obviously when COVID hit, myself and Andy Hiles, who's part of Scrum Facilitators, what are we going to do? It was literally, what are we going to do? So we saw what other people were doing, and I've got a camera facing us and I've got a camera facing down on the desk, and we just draw. So it's what is the simplest way that we can get our messages across? So either in person, flip charts or whatever, and with the aid of the various different technologies and breakout rooms and those things and Teams rooms, you can send people off to do the things that you need them to think about in pairs or in triads. But then just by having a webcam pointing down, drawing away, it's almost like a one-to-one relationship sometimes. So people are watching what you're doing.
I really enjoyed the book Visual Thinking by Wilhelmine Brand. I don't know if you've seen that book.
I haven't, but it's going to be one that I pick up. So
It plays very much into what you're saying, like how do you express yourself visually without being an artist, without having to have a canvas and oil paints? How do you do it in succinct but recognizable ways?
Yeah, I have a BSc honours 2-1 in computer studies. I don't use any of those skills anymore. You know, I'm coming out from training and I've got ink all over my fingers. And, you know, it's like, in fact, I remember one time I had a leaking pen and I didn't realise it was leaking and I kept touching my face and everybody kept laughing. It was like, what's why you've got pink on your face? It's like, oh, no, it's like, oh, it's just, Steve, stop touching your face because you keep moving.
Well, I think that's something I'm really going to think about now, because I love working visually. I did actually go to art school, so I actually did start off in the creative industries. And I've been thinking about how to do it, but because my team is quite hybrid, how do I get people involved in that? Or quite a lot of the time, some of our big meetings I like to do at home because I've got a really nice setup, but I'm missing that visual element of taking a leaf out your book for sure, being very inspired by your sessions. But I actually really like the idea of, just getting a webcam and pointing it down and saying,
so easy. We were trying to like work out how to, and I know some of the trainers, some of the facilitators use iPads and draw on there and it's live, but I literally have a pad of A4 white paper and some felt tips and a camera pointing down to it. And it's for those that are old enough, Take Heart with Tony Hart, which I'm really showing my age now, drawing a picture in front of a camera. And it's like, oh, what's that? He's drawing a windmill or something. Oh, he's now drawing the Scrum framework and how, or now he's throwing like Kanban stuff in there. And this is how, what happens on the flow kind of thing. So it's just however you can get concepts across to people, however you can get experiences across to people as well, is just get it. What works? You find out what works.
I think distilling that creative process is very much a human interest. So outside of work, I'm part of an improv group. And I think the reason why improv might not be in a way as funny as stand-up, because stand-up, you've got a lot of time to prep your set, be really sharp on it. Improv, you have no idea what you're going to do. Someone just gives you a suggestion. But what people like about improv, which is why I think that in a way it's successful as an art form in itself, is people love the creative process. They love watching the cogs turn. What is this person going to do next with this piece? And I think the visual element of explaining a concept is just like that. It's people just actually, where is this going and where can I springboard off of?
Yeah.
And people really enjoy that, being a participant in that. It's like you say, you could just do a PowerPoint presentation and say, well, the Agile Manifesto says this and that, and and to pass the exam, you're going to have to do this, which is what, I'll be honest with you, when I was put on the course, I was fully expecting it's going to be one of those courses, and it totally wasn't.
Good, because that's what we were aiming for, was the total opposite of what you were expecting. I've been on courses that are just like, oh dear God, please let this end. And then what I'd like is the people going away is like, okay, that's changed the way I've thought I think about things. And it could be nothing to do with the subject, but like you've said, I picked up some other skills along the way that I could use. The course content was rubbish, but hey, I know now how to do a liberating structure that's going to actually encourage people to talk in my teams, which as a coach is often the most difficult things to do, especially over remote and hybrid ways, of the fact that we now do have these barriers that we can put up, like turn the camera off and stuff like that. It's like, okay, so how are we going to broach that? How are we going to try and break down some of these things that have been not forced on us, but the working environment has changed, and it's how do we respond to that change? So it is difficult.
So one question we often ask quite a lot of our guests when they come on the show is, can you describe your experience of working with cybersecurity teams? What has been the challenge and what's been good? Now, you can draw upon your time as a dev, but it'd be also interesting. You may not have. I might be the only person that did your course and then went on to do cybersecurity. But any experiences you've had?
I have. I mean, I was working for Sky for a long, long time, like 10 years, 9 years. And I kept going away and coming back. So I'm going to say it's 10 years. And as a developer, there'd be often things that we'd be creating and going, oh, that'd be fine. And then cybersecurity team would come in and go, no, you can't do that. You can't open that port. You can't do that. You can't do this. You can't do that. That's, it's not encrypted. Oh, all right, we're nearly finished. So there's obviously frustration. And then with all, they're protecting us. It's like, what's the analogy? You need them there, but all the badness that's out there, all those people that will try and break your system. And you can always go down the happy path and think, yes, it's fine. No, they'll never do that, but they will. And they will try and do it. And especially if it's a high profile target, they will do it. But maybe because me as a developer, either naively or just not knowing, is like, well, I didn't know about that. So having that cybersecurity team available to me and going, yeah, if you do that, you really are making your attack area very, very wide. And when I was fortunate to be head of tech at Sky, I was in Sky Identity. I mean, some of the things that the folks used to tell me about what was going on and who was trying to get in and all those kinds of who was trying this weekend. Oh, it was so-and-so, in the Far East or Middle East or wherever. It was just, Eastern Europe. And it's like, well, how did we do it? Oh, we're tracking. And it's like, and we stopped them getting in and there was, it looks some sort of breach. So actually having them as a first line of defense, where their first position is not to assume positive intent, whereas my, as a developer, oh, it's fine. I'm just whatever. They're, you know, it's no, I'm assuming that everybody is out there to hurt me or hurt us. So therefore, I'm not going to allow that. Or if we do that, it's going to open up. And it's very similar in a way. And forgive me for this. The mindset of a software engineer versus the mindset of a developer that specializes in testing, an engineer that specializes in testing. And I'm really choosing my language very carefully there because testers are developers. They've just specialized in testing. Mm-hmm. As you have specialized in cybersecurity, if you, you know, as I could specialize in back end. But yet when we go into teams, it's like, oh, they're the developers and they're the testers, and we throw work at them. It's like, no, they are all developers. They have just got different specialities. So having that mindset from a developer point of view into a test point of view, it's a totally different way of thinking. It's the kind of, the, well, how are you going to test this? Cybersecurity, how are you going to make sure this is safe? How are you going to make sure no harm comes to one, us, to the people using our service? And then when that data, you know, there is a data breach or a data incident, what impact does that have on us and also the individual that data has gone missing from? You know, where's that impact? So having somebody there within your team going, yeah, in a great world, that would be fine. But you have just punched a big hole in that everybody can come through. Maybe we want to block that up.
Mm. What else could really, like, cybersecurity or security team or people involved in the security profession do to kind of make your life easier?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I was taken back to when I was head of tech. And for me, it was always, and this is, they could make it easier for me by dumbing it down a little bit because I can't be across everything. And I suppose it's, you know, the different approach, different techniques. And it's just actually one of the things, regardless, walk in the other person's shoes. What's the thing you need them to know? And how can you get it across their head? Just so, not that it's like, oh, we're using X, Y, and Z. I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounds like a lot. And yeah, okay, fine. Just do it. Help me understand the threat. Help me understand why. There you go. Help me understand the why behind it, but do it in a way that you're not going to lose me in a conversation. And I suppose that's where all of us, when we interact with anybody in the teams, it's like looking at them going, do they get what I'm on about? And if they don't, then how am I going to help them understand? Because they might not say, and I, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. There's many times I had conversations and it was like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounds really good. And it sounds, you're telling me. So therefore, let's just do it anyway. And, you know, it's going over the top of my head, but it could have been needed. It might not have been. It's like I say, it's on any team. Help people understand the why behind what's going on. Don't just assume they understand, because 9 times out of 10 they don't. But they don't want to say.
I guess on the flip side, what do you think cybersecurity teams misunderstand about what you do in your, you know, in your role, I guess, in more general terms?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose in most teams just think, And I always say I'm a scrum master coach, and it's like, well, what do you do? You just manage the daily. You just manage, you know, you update Jira, don't you? You do X.
Yeah, I was going to say, Steve, that's the impression that I get when I join a team that's maybe just, this exists, join a team that's newly sort of embedding agile methodologies. They're like, oh, I don't understand this. I've never had to work with an agile team before. What does a scrum master do? And it sounds like a bit of a cakewalk. So I know it's not. So please explain what you do.
It is totally dependent on the situation and the context of what's needed. I mean, there's a whole podcast in its own right about what does a scrum master do. I would say that a scrum master is there to help the team, to help the individual reach their full potential in a professional way. So it is not to tell people what to do, because then that's going to undermine professionalism. That's going to undermine self-management. It's going to undermine, it's quite demoralizing, to be fair. And micromanagement, nobody likes. It's to create the environment in which the team and the individual thrives, that working in a complex world where there are more unknowns than knowns. How a scrum master does that will depend on the person and the situation that they're in. It could be that they're coaching. And by coaching, I mean a true sense of coaching is not coming with an answer and trying to get the person to get there. That's kind of mentoring. It's like help moving them forward. But scrum masters also mentor as well. But coaching is saying, okay, what would be the right thing to do here? And I've been a scrum master in a petrochemical company. And I remember talking to people who are using agile frameworks on platforms offshore. And they would look to me and say, what do you think? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounds like you're having a really good conversation. From what I know of where you are, you're not breaking any of the guidance within the framework. You're okay. Keep having this conversation. What do you need from me? Do you need me to keep people away so you have this? Do you need me to keep focused? Is there some misalignment in trust within the team? And that's often the first thing when I'm going to organizations is to say, let's just have a look at this team. How mature is it? And irrespective of the framework, what's the relationships like in here? What's the hidden ways of working here? What are the unwritten rules of working in this crazy department that we always seem to find all of ourselves in? How do we help people work better together? And that could be, hey, let's just have a conversation about what it's like to work here. Let's have a conversation about the working agreement, especially now we're working remotely or hybrid. You know, what's acceptable behavior? What do we do when there is dissent? Is some form of dissent okay? What about language? You know, what if somebody is dominating a conversation and they're swearing? Is that okay in this organization? I've worked in organizations, that's absolutely fine. I've worked in other organizations where that is, you know, no, you don't use language like that, but it depends on there. So coming back to the Scrum Master, what do? You're a coach, you're a mentor, a teacher, facilitator. You are a North Star pointing in the direction of this is a way to go, underpinned with professionalism. And by professionalism, I mean, okay, we understand the framework, either Scrum, the strategy of flow within Kanban, that we're doing the right thing. Doesn't mean we will always have the same and the best outcomes. It's just we are doing the best that we can do given the situation that we can do. So, and a Scrum Master is not a junior role. And a Scrum Master, because I've been in organizations where, oh, you're a Scrum Master and you've got, oh, you report into an Agile coach that used to be a Scrum Master. A Scrum Master is an Agile coach. They've just chosen to use Scrum for the time being to focus on delivery. They should have other experiences as well. And most good Scrum Masters have other experiences, such as myself as being a developer, such as myself as being a head of tech, such as loads of brilliant people out there that they can fall back on. And often the conversation goes, is this the right way that we should be going? And you're just wanting somebody to go yes or no. And if they don't, you have to go, right, how am I going to phrase this question that somebody's going to talk up? Because if I lead this group, they're always going to come to me. So what I need to do is create some self-management within the team. How we do that is open up to loads of other different conversations. And it is incredibly difficult to do it remotely and hybrid. It was difficult anyway, when we were all physically in an office. It's even more complex and more hard than previously now, because of this interaction we have through a screen. We can just turn it off. We miss body language. I mean, I'm using my hands a lot now, and I can see hopefully that you two are listening because you're smiling and nodding. But if you didn't have that camera turned on, I've no idea if you're listening to what I'm talking about. So it's really difficult. So hopefully I've answered your question of what a Scrum Master does. I could have just done the it depends, but there's so much more.
I'm sure somebody would troll and say, oh, it's just a project manager, right?
Yeah, and they will. And I've seen Scrum Masters that have behaviors of project managers. And I've seen project managers that have behaviors associated with Scrum Masters. And it's whatever's needed for that situation.
It's an interesting one, because I think it just dips back into a point you made earlier about, well, testing should be, you know, often part of engineering. And I think we do often think very dualistic terms about, well, that's a tester, that's a developer, that's a Scrum Master, that's a project manager. Like in the world, in the real world, not everything is sort of dualistic, is it? We often do a number of different things that don't necessarily need a different job title.
No, and one of the changes that happened in the Scrum framework in November 2020 was that they changed the wording from role to accountability. So it said you could be, as long as there is somebody within the team that has the accountability of a Scrum Master or accountability of a product owner, you could do Scrum. Because one of the things that we're seeing was that we can't do Scrum because we don't have a product owner. We've got a product lead, developer, manager, whatever. So we're going to mangle this framework, this scaffolding around complex work, more uncertainty, and we're going to mangle it to fit us because we don't have this job title. It's like, well, okay, all we're saying is there should just be somebody with the accountability of X. Going back to playing football at school, rush goalkeeper. Okay, so this is really not showing my age, but like just maybe simplifying a bit too much. When you are playing, if you're in the box and you shout rush, you can pick up the ball. You're the goalkeeper for that bit of time because you don't have the ability to have outfield players and a goalkeeper. Okay, so the accountability is if you're in the box and the ball's in the box and you shout rush, keeper, whatever they've decided, you are then that keeper and you can kick it out. But it rotates. But we all understand that accountability of that rush goalkeeper at that time. And I'm really dumbing this down and because people go, oh no, it's wrong. It's having the understanding. But what we as of what's accountable behavior. Yeah, accountable behavior when that goalkeeper, when that person's in the is acting as a goalkeeper, as much as we're working as a team. And what we're trying to do as individuals that are working in a complex area is to work in the best team that we can. The way that you can do that is by people understanding their accountabilities. And I really don't care whether you're called a Scrum Delivery Lead Manager or you're a Product Delivery Master, whatever. If you're saying you're doing Scrum, and that's your job title, if you're doing Scrum, professional Scrum, in which we're focused around a goal and an outcome and delivering value, as long as there is somebody within that group of people has the accountabilities of those three things, Product Owner, Scrum Master, and developers, brilliant. Because people then understand what we need and what they are accountable for to help the team deliver. So call them whatever you want. Sorry, I can't remember the question before, so I kind of went off on a tangent, but I'm not too sure. Call it
name. You answered it. Do you think there's any scope for cybersecurity teams to work in a Scrum fashion then? Can anyone do it? Anyone join the party?
Yeah, look, Scrum is a conversational framework. Andy Hiles, my partner in crime, kind of, I'm laughing because partner in crime just kind of get the connotations. He said Scrum is a conversational framework. It will encourage you to have the right conversations. I know Scrum has been used in petrochemical companies. I know that it's been used in marketing. I know it's been used in the homes. Anywhere it's complex, where there's uncertainty, Scrum will encourage you to have the right conversations. It won't fix your problems. It will just encourage you on a daily basis to go, hey, how are we doing moving towards that goal? How are we doing with our feedback from our stakeholders? Are we building the right thing? Are we delivering? Have we highlighted what's going on? Have we made it transparent? Are we inspecting and are we adapting? So assuming that the cybersecurity team is in a world of more unknowns than knowns, yes, you can use Scrum. If they are in a world of, we have done this so many times before, we don't need these tight feedback loops. And that's what Scrum is, a tight feedback loop. We don't need these. We know what we're doing. We hit here, we do that. We've done it. It's easy. Scrum may not be the right approach for you. It is contextual for where you are. And as a Scrum professional, as a coach out there, it's often when people come on the courses with us, we go, hey, maybe Scrum isn't the solution that you're looking for. Have you considered using Kanban? Have you considered using traditional approaches? Have you considered doing something else? Because it sounds like that you've got everything in place, but where you are doesn't actually suit the benefits of what Scrum can bring. You don't need short feedback loops. You don't need, you know, so, but as long as you know what it actually is and not what you believe it to be, you can have a conversation around it. Because what tends to happen with Scrum, because it is simple, people pick it up and go, oh yeah, we can do that. And then it gets malformed into something else. And the person that malformed it leaves the organization and they're doing something else now. Oh, well, we've got to do that because Dave said that and Dave came from X company and they were really good. And so you have to use story points. You have to use velocity and burn down charts and all this other stuff that kind of gets lumped in. So understand it well and do it well. So to come back to your question, sorry, Leon, I keep going off in different tangents. Can cybersecurity teams? Yes, assuming that they're in the right area that is suitable for Scrum. So it's know where you are.
Mm-hmm. I think I found it's interesting when Agile and Scrum and other similar kind of things are misunderstood. People revert to dogma. That's the biggest enemy, in my opinion, the biggest enemy of any kind of agile approach is people just going, well, it says it on the page and that's what we should do without actually using their brain or having a conversation.
If I ever hear a Scrum Master, and I used to do this, and it was like, the Scrum Guide says, and it's like, no, don't start a conversation with the Scrum Guide says you have to have a 15-minute meeting in which you talk about whatever. Talk about the why, the purpose behind that coming together of people working behind a goal. There's more value in it there. So, and I often see this, we're following dogma. We don't, it's too rigid for us. It's, you know, it's like, well, look for the purpose as opposed to, and this is where, if you look online, some people call it mechanical Scrum or zombie Scrum or mechanical Kanban and all kind of stuff, mechanical framework. If you understand the why, and this is where it comes from, experienced people, when they understand the why, that can help other people that say, this is why we get together. And this is why feedback's important. This is why transparency is important. This is why we as a collective need to work on a focused outcome. Okay, people get it, as opposed to, well, this author or this book or this person on LinkedIn says you have to do X, Y, and Z. It might be perfect for them in their situation. It might be the worst thing possible for your situation.
Mm. On a similar kind of track, I mean, you've described before coaching as having the courage to look at team dysfunctions and pull them out of it. Kind of, what techniques can you recommend to our listeners to start having these kind of difficult conversations and fixing team dysfunctions?
Well, bearing in mind that probably the most dysfunctional team often is the cybersecurity team, because nobody wants to talk to them.
Yeah, it's often it can be how people view that team. So addressing dysfunctions as a coach is really difficult. Like I said earlier, if somebody doesn't want to be coached, there's very little you can do. You can keep pointing at things and go, hey, there's a damp patch in that corner. What should we do about it? Hey, there's this problem. Has anyone else noticed this, or is it just me? As a coach, you should point things out, because that's what you're there to do. How you do that, again, is like answering the question about what does a scrum master do? It depends on the team. So it could be that we just have a frank and open conversation. The fact that, hey, I'm noticing that every time you and I talk, Jeff, that you roll your eyes. What's going on there? Or something like that. Or I'm, you know, but we're based on that, on having a good relationship between each other. And the fact that we've got a history, we know each other. And if I ask that, you're not going to be offended and I'm going to get an answer back. If I don't know you and I notice that you keep doing it all the time, I'm going to try and build up some rapport with you. I'm going to try and get to know you. It's not going to be the first question that I ask. We're going to try and build a relationship, because that's what is important to work through the dysfunctions. I suppose undermining the dysfunction would, yeah. So to work through the dysfunctions is building up relationships. And often we hear this thing about psychological safety, and I'm going to tread carefully, because you could Google loads of things about psychological safety. Psychological safety for myself is that the team feel that they can say things and they are not concerned, or they are not concerned with the feedback that they will get back from them, that individual, because they've said something. They're open to it. It's not psychological safety as this, well, I can just say anything to you and then I can throw this shield around myself going, no, psychological safety, there's nothing you can say to me. You know, that's how I feel. It's, you need to be prepared that something will come back as well. And if you're okay with that, there is that psychological safety in there. So first things first, observe the team, see what's going on. Was it just one thing happening? Does it happen quite a lot? Who's the vocal people? What's people talking about? What is the dynamic like in that team? It could just be that that is the normal team dynamic and you're new and you're just not used to it. It could be that actually there isn't this. It's not normal. There is something going on. Tread carefully and just see what's going on. Ask questions. Ask open questions. Hey, how is everyone today? And what's going on? Has anyone else noticed those things within the, you know, was it just me? I'm curious. Can someone explain to me what was going on there? Did anyone else notice that? So it's coming with an open mind and curious mind, and also not having a fixed mind on the outcome. I've tried it so many times enough that, oh, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. We get to X, Y and Z never comes, because we go off on a different tangent. And it's like having those different paths available to you, so you can go, okay, well, that was not what I was expecting, but looks like I now have this thread to work on. Or I found somebody else that thinks the same, therefore I'm going to help build an ally in a positive way of, maybe it's not always me that brings it up. Maybe somebody else feels confident to bring it up as well. So yeah, hopefully that helped.
Yeah, and I think one thing I do when I do my consultancy work and people say, I'd like to change cybersecurity culture in my organization. And I always say, actually, it starts with you.
Yeah.
You need to get your house in order before you start wanting to push your cybersecurity evangelism out on other people. Because if you don't have that psychological safety, if you don't have those honest conversations within yourself, you're not ready to go out there and talk about cybersecurity. You need to really look inwards, which is why I think that type of coaching is really important, about having those difficult conversations. And if you can't have those difficult conversations in a cybersecurity team, when you're faced with, as you alluded to earlier, you know, constant stress, the constant fear of bad things happening. That was one of the things that sort of struck me when I first joined the industry, is like, I'm going to have to live in a constant state of pessimism. That everyone somebody is out to get me. Yeah, someone's always out to get me. And that's the kind of mindset I have to be able to do my job. And it takes its toll. And I think it does, not always, but I think it can erode relationships. And I think perhaps maybe that's one of the reasons why cybersecurity teams are unapproachable. Because if you are constantly thinking in the negative, it's going to have a toll eventually. And so you need that really great outlet within your team so that if you can have these honest conversations, blow off steam and things. So when you go out into the wider organization, they don't always just see there's that person who's always down the dumps because they're scared they're going to get hacked.
Yeah, very true. Very, very true. You know, see the individual, not just their role, and just checking in. Hey, how are you? Leanne, how are you doing? Oh, you know, I've had a really horrible weekend because, wow, that sounds awful. And so it's empathizing with people. And, you know, but actually, you know, how are you? You don't look your cheerful self anymore. Or it's just that it's a lot of just human connection and just picking up on those signs. And then as a coach, as a scrum master, as an individual, just you don't actually, as any member of a team, just checking in with people. What's going on? You know, you're normally quite bubbly, or you normally tell a joke, or you look a bit down. What's here? And that's a real coach. What's here? Some people get really turned off by that. It's like, well, hey, what's happening? Kind of thing. Yeah,
absolutely. So, and I think that first initial step, though, can be very daunting. So
yes,
that initial nerve of reaching out to people, especially for the first time, for example, you know, I think that's the benefits and the downfalls of things like instant messenger, you know, things like Slack and Teams and things like that is we kind of hide behind a screen. But as you alluded to earlier, it's a lot harder to build relationships that way for a screen, particularly a screen when you've got no video as well. So like in Messenger.
Very true. You're looking at an image of Garfield or something like that. And you're trying to say how...
I hate that. Just like a little kind of aside is if you're going to put an avatar on there, please be the actual person so that when you, because it's so, it puts me on such a back foot when I go, finally do go into the office and someone goes, oh, hi, Leanne. Yeah, you say hi, Leanne, because you know what I look like because you've seen me. Whereas I don't know who you are because you're Garfield.
Yeah, definitely. Unless you do look like Garfield, obviously put Garfield up.
Then I'll say, hi, Garfield.
Then we can get there's a couple of things. I mean, it's so, so easy to put the barriers and so easy to break them down just by turning a camera. But I know we're peering into people's homes and we're peering into people's lives and it might not be suitable, but blur the background. Put a fake background on or something just so people know, you know, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't walk into an office with a bag over your head. So, you know, I'm not here. And one of the things that we've struggled with in the past is people, and you mentioned it there a lot on Slack, people taking messaging the wrong way. And what I don't always do it. What I try and remind myself to do is get on a call like we are, face to face. You know, it's over Teams, but see the person. It's so easy just to keyboard warrior, send loads of messages and read the wrong intent on something. But it's really difficult for somebody to be rude to you, to the face. And then if you ask them to say it again, whatever it is, they probably won't. And there's something that, and sorry to keep going on about Scrum, there's something that always kind of hopefully makes me do the right thing. It's the Scrum values. Open courage, commitment, respect, focus as well. I can't believe I forgot focus. It's some of those difficult conversations I don't want to have, but I know I need to have it. Either respect for myself, respect for the other individual, or having courage. I've got a really difficult conversation to have with somebody. It's always easier to just shy away from it. Always easier. I'll wait till Monday to do that. It's Friday afternoon. I'm going to wait till Monday. Oh, okay. Or I'll wait till the next time it happens. And there's a book. Oh, what's it called? Radical Candor. Is it Kim Scott? Have I just missed? I think it is. Jeff's nodding.
It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah. And she talks about this opening. Is it like in the opening paragraph, opening chapter, where somebody is underperforming and the whole team is letting that person get away with underperforming? And then eventually they come to a bit where they've got to let this person go. And the person says, why didn't you tell me you weren't happy? Why did you cover for me? I didn't know. I was doing what I thought was a good job. And if we let people, if we don't step forward and have those difficult conversations, we will find ourselves in those situations time and time again. It comes with experience of basically being bitten too many times, going, I'm going to have to try and have this conversation, even though I don't want to. And this is where, like, the Scrum values for myself, honing into that professionalism, says, Steve, you're going to have a really difficult conversation. And it's never as bad as you imagine it to be as well, because often it is like somebody says, thank you. Thank you for reaching out to me. Yeah, I was being off, or I just had X, or I didn't realize. Yeah, now you've said this. I had it on LinkedIn the other day, actually. I posted something and somebody said something and I misread it, and I was, you know, keyboard warrior. and wrote mm-hmm. back and then stopped myself. Well, actually, no, I posted it and then they corrected the comment and I went, oh no, I've read it the wrong way as well. Okay. And then I deleted. And then we had a conversation in the background going, mm-hmm. I'm really sorry. And they were saying, yeah, I could. And he was a non-native English speaker. And it was just the way context of text in that moment went wrong. So much easier to sort it out later on. But yeah, Scrum values, professionalism. I'm going to have to, correcting my English even, that's professionalism. I'm going to have this conversation. When do I have it? Sooner or later. Let's have it sooner. Those kinds of things will always encourage me to do it.
Well, slightly different though. Thinking about working, I've worked in the past in Scrum teams and I've worked in traditional teams where there's been enormous teams of 25 plus and the communication flows are just insane. Nowadays, we're starting to shift left on some things and become more collaborative, which is a good thing. Yeah. And we're trying to break down silos. But then when it comes to things like team composition, I think imagine like including people, more and more people in the teams, we found that it's getting difficult to structure teams of sort of 6 to 8 people, and even in some cases of 10 people. And as the technology is becoming more complex, how do we kind of handle the complexity of we need more disciplines and more, you know, as tech just grows, more disciplines and more people involved without making enormous teams again going backwards into the dark age? Well, how do we deal with that?
I guess building on that, Jeff, I guess the real question is, bring it back to cybersecurity, is, okay, you've got your established Scrum team. Hi, I'm from the security team. Can I join in? And, oh, hi, I'm from the accessibility team. Can I join in? When does that become too much?
Ask the team. Hey, team, how do you want to work? We've got these people. They have this knowledge. They have these skills. We don't have this. We've got 200 people all working on one piece of work. How do you want to work? And if we're using a framework, these are the boundaries. These are the safe areas we can play in. Folks, how do you want to do this? Bearing in mind, we need to keep lots of good communication. How do we want to communicate? Is it over Slack or is it email or just jump on a call? How do we want to check in with people on a regular basis? Why are we going to... So ask the team. And we won't get it right to start off with, but over time it will evolve. And this is what it means to work in this team. If you go in as an individual and go, this is what you're going to do. You've got 10 people. You're going to be this. Oh, you're the cybersecurity people. You're going to come in every third sprint and you're going to do this. You're going to accessibility. You're going to do no. You're going to have way too much moving parts and you will be wrong. Ask the people doing the work how they want to work. Self-management. And because they then take ownership for it instead of going, Steve, we knew that would never work, but you told us and you're a grade above us. So we didn't want to tell you that you were wrong. I wish you had, because we've just wasted a load of time and a load of money on this. So often it's like, hey, here's a problem. Here's a load of people. How do you want to work? What are the rules of this engagement? What's our working engagement like? What are we going to do? Give them some guidance, give them some boundaries, and this is it. So also make people welcome when they do come into teams. And Leanne, I was just thinking about your, you know, accessibility person coming in. I mean, we're going back to Tuckman about teams forming, storming and norming, performing and then adjourning. Anybody leaves, anybody joins, the team dynamic will change. So as a coach, as a leader, just make sure people understand the ethos, the culture of the team. When people come in, make sure you know their name. Oh, you know, you're not Garfield, you're Leanne. Oh, okay, Leanne, what do you do? Hey, Leanne, tell us about something. And, you know, I've worked in large teams, 16 people plus, and we would like just playful stuff. This is definitely over COVID. It was like, tell two truths and a lie. You know, we'll see what we can get. Just to build up that rapport and having regular catch-ups, not daily scrums, just a catch-up, just an opportunity for people to talk to one another. And I'm seeing it more and more where team bonding, or we actually have, I mean, obviously over COVID, it was always done virtually, but now we can get back into an office if possible. I know, you know, might be working with somebody in, I don't know, South Africa, and you're based in Aberdeen or somewhere like that. It's difficult to physically get into an office. But if you can, get into an office and don't do, and you know, obviously I'm from a software background, don't do coding, do team building stuff, getting to know how this team works. And it's a cost of now doing business, you know, like, because maybe you are 100% remote. And so organizations aren't paying for heating in buildings and then we've managed to downsize, but physically getting people together in an office and going, hey, I didn't realize you were 7 foot tall. Hey, I didn't realize that you were, you know, all that kind of stuff, physically getting to know people, spending time team building, working agreements, just talking to each other, building those bonds, just so that you've got it. And don't be Don't assume that people know things. So repeat yourself often. What's our vision? What's our goal? What's this person doing in the team? It's playground rules, really.
That's an interesting just little aside there. One thing, like, we have a daily scrum quite often, but how often do people just forget what the purpose is of what they're building?
Yeah.
And there's no, like, once a week or once every, you know, a couple of days ago, here's our vision and mission and what we're building.
Yeah. And this is often this gets missed out, is the sprint goal. And don't write sprint goals, finish Jira number 647, 6478, and think, write it around an outcome focused thing that you're going for, because that should then also underpin the product goal, the reason why we're doing something for these next couple of sprints or iterations or whatever. But here's the direction that we're heading in. And if you're a product owner or product manager, reiterate the product vision, the product goal multiple times. And you know when you're doing it enough, when people quote it back at you and you go, shut up, Steve, we know what the vision is. Brilliant. I've done my job then, because that's the direction. Because there's, from that vision, all other decisions can be made. So there's we're kind of going into Scrum more and more, shifting the conversation around on the daily of what you did yesterday, what you're doing today, got any impediment. Forget that. It's a practice. I'd much rather have a conversation around a goal. Hey, we're going to improve cybersecurity. We're going to fix that hole there that is allowing X to come through. We might know how we're going to do that, but the outcome is that we bring down the portcullis or whatever and only allow people in that we want to come in or whatever. So there's the goal. How we achieve it is up to the team. But yeah, talk about the goals.
Oh, I love that. Very much so. And one thing people do enjoy about me coming into the office is they go, oh, Leanne, I didn't know that you were 4'11". And I quite like having that air of mystery and having that surprise on them. So I have one final question for you, if you have time. And
sure.
You have said in the past that there is one sign of a badly facilitated meeting. What is it and how do we prevent it?
There's two that's come into me. A bad sign of a badly facilitated meeting is when sweets come in to keep people's attention. And this is somebody that another Scrum facilitator in the Netherlands said to me, Jasper Alblas. He said, Steve, if you have to bring in candy for people to come to a meeting, it's not important. Kind of thing. So, but I have done it in the past. I have done that in the past. I mean, facilitation is a skill. Making sure people understand why we're there, what the outcome could be, keeping people on track, keeping people on time, keeping people focused on a conversation, not going down rabbit holes, which I always tend to do. Go down rabbit holes of something that it not relating to the conversation, bringing people back, being neutral as well as a facilitator. And, you know, you're not fixed to a fixed outcome, but it's just keeping people focused. And often I didn't mean to say, I'm just going back to all those other meetings where people are on the phones, people are on the laptops, they're not paying attention to the actual conversation. And so it takes twice as long because we're not focused. Maybe if we just close the laptops, close the phones off, put them to a side and go, right, how can we achieve X? What's going on? What do we want to learn from this thing? What are we going to do? We haven't got any distractions. We could be in and out quicker. And we actually go do the stuff that we want to do. Enabling people to talk freely as well as, you know, facilitating that conversation. If you've got the CTO or whoever, and if you've got somebody higher up in the chain of organization in the thing, one of the things that we may want to talk about is actually, look, we're all peers in this room. I mean, it links into at Pixar and the Brain Trust. I've forgotten the guy's name that wrote the book, Catmull. Oh, what's his name? Jeff Catmull? Yes, I think that's him. Anyway, sorry. Talks about the Brain Trust. Facilitation there, providing feedback. We assume that everybody has positive intent. We are all peers. We are all saying what we wanted to say, not the fact that we don't want to embarrass ourselves or embarrass our peers. We are being honest. Ed Catmull. Sorry, I knew that would come to me if I just kept on talking. So taking out that organizational hierarchy is key to actually having good conversations. Yes, you've got an organizational hierarchy. It's there. Just recognize it and go, okay, you might not be the most knowledgeable person in this room. Using liberating structures, for example, great way of finding out what actually we should do, as opposed to, well, because Steve said it and he's the CEO, we're going to do that. No, let's not do that. Let's just see what the group thinks within reason. Because if we're going to sell the company, the CEO needs to know.
That'd be a right decision, wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, Steve, in line with what you've been discussing, the goal of this podcast is to ensure that people working in cybersecurity get a flavor for other teams working in tech, but also how people go approach transformation, collaboration, and start innovating better. And I think you've definitely helped us meet that goal. Cool. So thank you so much for your time today, Steve. If people want to reach out to you and get in touch, how do they do so?
On LinkedIn, Steve Trapps, TRAPPS, scrumfacilitators.com, theagiletrainer.com. But yeah, LinkedIn is probably going to be the best way that I'll, and look, yeah, I'm here to help. It's something that I'm really passionate about. I'm here to help because I was going to say it shouldn't be this difficult. It will always be difficult, but I want to pass on my experience. I want to help.
And I think you are definitely the man to do so. As I have been wax lyricaling about your training style so much, I definitely would recommend our listeners go seek him out. So thank you so much for your time today. It's been a blast.
Thank you. Pass the sweets, Leanne.
Oh, you cheeky thing. I don't need sweets to sweeten the deal. Although I did actually fund the Cybersecurity Awareness Department my last job to hand out chocolate fish whenever someone reported a genuine fish, and that always went down very well.
Delicious.
So, what do you think, listeners? Can cybersecurity teams actually do Scrum?
Do you practice it in your team or a variation thereof?
We'd love to hear about it, so do get in touch and let us know, and we'll read it out in future episodes.
Yeah, we'd love to hear some stories about your teams doing this well. Or, you know, as per the last episode, about learning from failure, not doing well.
Me too. Now, listeners, while I've just got you for a few seconds more, I just want to plug a conference that Jeff and I will be speaking at in October. It's called AI for the Rest of Us, and it'll be in London on the 24th and 25th of October, and listeners to the show can get a discount on tickets.
Yeah, I'll be presenting my brand new talk, The Four Horsemen of the Information Apocalypse, Taming the Wild West of Information Overload, to talk about misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, and non-information. Should be exciting.
Sounds really good. I've not even listened to it myself yet. It's all brand new. And I will also be presenting something I've not presented before. It's called Never Neutral, AI Development Past, Present, and Future in Anthropological Research.
I wonder how much has changed.
Not much. No. Spoiler alert. Anyways, if you want a discount code, drop us a line on our website via our Contact Us page or DM us on LinkedIn. We hope to see you there. Plug over.
Really looking forward to that one. Links to everything Steve discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word and get high-quality guests like Steve on in future episodes.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?